right, my friends, welcome to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and that was my interview of Dr. Ron Paul. And since this part isn't going on antiwar.com, I can go ahead and say I support Ron Paul for President of the United States. I'm really glad he's running. I think, you know, in some alternate universe, it's possible for him to break through the media blackout and the perception that he's somehow unelectable or whatever, and could actually be the President of the United States. I don't think it's probably going to work out this time, because in this reality, Lockheed rules. In this reality, the military-industrial complex and the New York financiers and the Israel lobby and the oil companies, they decide who's going to be the President of the United States, and we get to pick from two, and if they have their way, and they do have the billions, and they control the state as it is, so it's likely they will have their way. Ron Paul won't be one of those two that we get to choose from in November 2008. But I do wish him the best of luck, and I know that already, with the few media appearances that he has been granted, he's already helped spread the message of liberty to a lot of people, and you know, even if you're a leftist, you ought to support Ron Paul. The guy voted against the Patriot Act. He voted against the Iraq War, of course. In fact, right before the Iraq War, he introduced a resolution to repeal the authorization as the aluminum tubes and Niger uranium forgery stories were debunked. He tried to introduce a declaration of war just to call out the other members of the House Foreign Relations Committee in October of 2002 and say, you guys want a war, then you take responsibility. You vote to declare war. And they said, yeah, right. And in fact, Henry Hyde, who you may remember from the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment of the disgraced, impeached President George, Bill Clinton. They're all so much alike, it's hard to tell them apart sometimes. The upside down smile and everything like that. But, Henry Hyde told Ron Paul, oh, that's anachronistic. Come on, the power of Congress to declare war. This is the future and stuff. We don't deal with that. Yeah, he's for sound money. He's against the drug war. He's against foreign interventionism. And, you know, at least read about him. Do a Google search. Read a couple of his speeches before the Congress. Go look through Ron Paul's archives at antiwar.com. Go look at what he wrote in the months leading up to the war. Almost all of which are, you know, speeches that he wrote and gave before the House of Representatives. He's better than any of the Democrats. Democrats aren't anti-war. Democrats are hardly anti-war. Give me a break. Barack Obama announced the other day and was contradicted by his superior, Harry Reid, that, oh, yeah, we'll fund the war. Yeah, after Bush vetoes this thing we just passed that I voted for to fund the war, as long as Bush doesn't say that he's met benchmarks, which it's totally up to him to say whether he's met or not. Yeah, after he vetoes that, yeah, we'll go ahead and pass all the money he wants. This is just a stunt. That's what Barack Obama admitted the other day. And then Harry Reid, his boss, the majority leader, the head Democrat in the U.S. Imperial Senate, said, no, that's not right. Actually, if he vetoes this, we're going to pass another authorization. And this one will have an iron deadline that troops out by a year from now, the end of March 2008. So yeah, right, we'll see whether Harry Reid delivers on that whatsoever after Bush's promised veto of the half-assed withdrawal bill that they've passed thus far. But yeah, Barack Obama, every anti-war Democrat's greatest, most favorite hero, the guy who threatens Iran pretty much every chance he gets. And the guy who, since he's been in the position to vote up or down on Bush's war, has voted aye every single time, has voted to fund Bush's war on every single vote. So, you know, if, you know, you are one of the 2% or something of people who believe that America's relationship with the world is paramount at this point, yeah, you might want to look somewhere other than the Democratic Party. And I might try to point you in the direction of the Libertarian Republican congressman from District 14 in South Texas near the Gulf Coast, Dr. Ron Paul. Delivers babies for a living. That's his real job. You know, at the end of every year, Ron Paul gives money back to the Treasury that his office did not spend. He's the only congressman who does that, and he does it every time. So, yeah, that was my interview with Ron Paul. He's a hell of a guy. Why don't you go to YouTube? Go to YouTube and type in Ron Paul and watch some videos of Ron Paul. Watch some of his House floor speeches. Watch him slay Bill Maher and the numbskulls at Fox News. Do a little YouTube search for Ron Paul. Why not? This is Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. There's a phone number here. I guess I should have given it out already, but I will now. How's that? It's 646-646-646-646. If you want to call in the show, Anti-War Radio. And if you're out of town, that's 512. Come on, everybody's got cell phones and long distance is free. What's the big deal? 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446 to call in the show. And the biggest news, obviously, today is that the Iranians have agreed to return the captured British sailors and Marines. They're featured on TV this morning wearing very expensive-looking suits, and the reporter ladies said that they were on their way to the British embassy. So they should be back in the UK by tomorrow. I feel really sorry for George Bush. He was really wanting to try to somehow exploit this tragedy or whatever the hell it is, this confrontation that took place there in the Persian Gulf, and try to use it as his little Gulf of Tonkin if possible. And now that opportunity has been taken away. Another failure for George Bush. And, you know, that's not just rhetoric. I have here, and I mentioned this yesterday, from the Globe and Mail in the UK, the headline, this was the top story, at least for a time yesterday on antiwar.com, Washington hurting British bid to free crew. And it was all about how the British were trying to negotiate with the Iranians in a reasonable manner, and how the United States was doing everything they could to intervene and screw that up. So another failure for the Bush administration. And hang on the line there, caller. I'll get right to you. And then this is the number two story on antiwar.com today. ABC News exclusive. This is from the Blotter, investigative reporter blog from Brian Ross and Christopher Isham. ABC News exclusive, the secret war against Iran. Iranian militant group. Typo there. Something NR. A Pakistani tribal militant group responsible for a series of deadly guerrilla raids inside Iran has been secretly encouraged and advised by American officials since 2005. U.S. and Pakistani intelligence sources tell ABC News. The group called Jandula is made up of members of the Baluchi tribe and operates out of the Baluchistan province in Pakistan, just across the border from Iran. It has taken responsibility for the deaths and kidnappings of more than a dozen Iranian soldiers and officials. U.S. officials say the U.S. relationship with Jandula is arranged so that the U.S. provides no funding to the group, which would require an official presidential order or finding, as well as congressional oversight. Tribal sources tell ABC News that the money for Jandula is funneled to its youthful leader, Abd el Malik Reji, through Iranian exiles who have connections with Europe and Gulf states. And so anyway, this is just another piece in the puzzle. Again, you can find this story at the top of the page at antiwar.com today. ABC News exclusive, the secret war against Iran. That's from the ABC News investigative blog called Blotter. Not hard to find if you use your handy local search engine. And this is just another chapter in the story that's been written really for years now by Scott Ritter, Seymour Hersh, Larissa Alexandrovna, and other first-hand sources and investigative reporters like those. that America is financing terrorist groups against Iran, inside Iran. Azerbaijani groups, Pakistanis, obviously the Mujahideen El-Khalq, which is kind of a weird half-commie, half-cultish group centered around the cult of personality of this crazy woman who has declared herself Iran's president in exile. They used to, the MEK, the Mujahideen El-Khalq, they used to work for Saddam Hussein. They were his terrorists against Iran. Now they are ours. And as Scott Ritter wrote back in the spring of 2005, the war with Iran has already begun. It's just a matter of degrees. And the policy is regime change. It's not about their nuclear program. It's not about hurting American soldiers in Iraq. It's about the desire to change their regime regardless of the rest of these facts. And they're going to find a way to do it, at least find a way to bomb them. I don't know how the hell they think they're going to overthrow Tehran other than a full-scale invasion, which is impossible at this point since the American army is about spun out in Iraq as it is. But we'll see how it goes. But clearly, the Bush-Cheney regime continues to push for war with Iran. It's obviously what they want. Whether they'll get it or not, I guess, still remains to be seen. Now, let's go ahead and take a caller on Anti-War Radio. Hey, I'm Scott. Who are you? And welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. My name's Alex.
Hi, how's it going?
Thanks for inviting me to the show. Well, I had, one question or maybe two questions for you, and they concern both Iran and Iraq. I guess we can start with Iran since this is the war that we're about to move on to next. I just don't understand why we really want to go to war with Iran. And let me just, preface that question a little bit by saying I've listened to the interviews with Scott Ritter and I think Gordon Prather. I've listened to almost all the interviews that are on the antiwar.com radio site. And there isn't a lot of good information that comes out in most of the major media about this. But from what I could glean from these interviews, it appears that there's no real evidence of this clandestine weapons of mass destruction program that we fear Iran is going to have. The other thing, which actually might be knowledge to you, but might not be very well known to most people, is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty guarantees Iran the peaceful right to use nuclear technology.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like whenever you hear people talking about Iran, they don't want Iran to even have nuclear technology.
Right.
There's no evidence of the weapons of mass destruction.
Well, you've got it exactly right. I mean, that exactly is the deal. Scott Ritter explained this, I think, as good as you're going to ever hear it explained. Not that it's going to make sense, but it's, I guess the truth anyway. Scott Ritter, in his joint appearance with Seymour Hersh at the, I believe, the Society for American Ethics or something like that in New York last October, explained, and I asked him about this in my interview as well, that from the from the Israeli intelligence point of view, from the head of not necessarily the lower down staff or the real intelligence guys, but the bosses at Israeli intelligence, for Iran to have any nuclear material or ability technology whatsoever is tantamount to them being able to produce a nuclear weapon. For them to be able to spin a single centrifuge, even if it says it's okay in the non-proliferation treaty, even if IAEA inspectors are standing right there looking over their shoulder, that is tantamount to them having a nuclear weapon. And as such, according to their policy, this will not stand, etc. Something absolutely must be done about it. And I'm not exactly certain how it is they've done it, but they've convinced George Bush and Dick Cheney that that's the case.
Well, the other question, too, is if you look at a lot of what's been written by American Enterprise or some of these neocon think tanks, they say that the mullahs can't be trusted. It kind of puzzled me when I heard Scott Ritter say that the supreme mullah there in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, said that he renounced the use of nuclear weapons and thought it was against the principles of Islam to even have them.
Right. You don't hear that reported in the American press very often, do you?
No, you certainly don't. And it's kind of funny because we hear that Iran is just bent on genocide, that as soon as they have a nuclear, and this isn't what we hear from antiwar.com, but Just last night, I was listening to a crazy, crazy neocon talk show host, and I tried to call in and actually start an argument because they had somebody in there. I won't tell you what the talk show host name is, but you can say he's a real wiener. Anyway,
I have an idea of who you might mean.
Yeah, I think you do. And it just, I just couldn't believe that they're saying it. Essentially, they're implying that as soon as they have the nuclear technology, these people are bent on wiping out Israel. And it just, I mean, the funny thing is, if you really look into the case, it just doesn't seem that realistic. There's actually a Jewish, there's a small Jewish population in Iran. There are even Jewish members in their parliament. We talk about bringing democracy to the Middle East, and the democracy in Iran may not be perfect, but it's some sort of a mixture of a theocracy and a democracy there. I'm just not really persuaded that they're about to wipe out Iran. And,
nor am I. And, you know, never mind the fact that Israel, as everybody knows, has over 400 nuclear weapons, including based in submarines and everything else. So even if somehow Iran, you know, magically had a bunch of hydrogen bombs and could wipe Israel off the face of the earth, or even if they did, Israeli submarines would still wipe Persia off the face of the earth. And what good would that do to the Persians?
Well,
I think we're supposed to believe, you said your name is Alex, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Alex.
Alex, what we're supposed to believe is that they're crazy. They're crazy. You can't deal with them. You can't trust them. You can't deter them. Now, Joseph Stalin, you can deter him. But, you know, Mao Zedong, he can be deterred. But these people, no, 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 they just cannot be dealt with. And in fact, that's a lie. We know that the very people who say that are the very people who have done the most secret dealings with Iran in the since the Iranian Revolution. Sold them weapons and, you know, did secret dealings for hostages around Congress's authority and everything else. So, you know, the same people who say, you know, these people can't be dealt with are the same ones, you know, secretly meeting with them in Rome.
Well, that's, I mean, it's true. And the other thing is, it really glosses over, I think, a huge difference between the fundamentalist Shiites and the fundamentalist Sunnis, the Wahhabists. The Shiites don't really talk about a global jihad. That's not really on their agenda. Even Hassan Nasrallah, this is not really their goal, is to basically, and this is what I was hearing last night on a crazy conservative talk show host, and it's just pure propaganda, is essentially they're not going to stop with Israel. They're just going to try to wipe out all of Western civilization. I'm sorry about laughing at this.
Well, no, it is. It's ridiculous.
What's being spouted.
Yeah.
And it just puzzles me. I don't understand, other than Iran's support for maybe Hezbollah and Hamas, I don't really understand why, what the beef with Iran really is.
You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it depends who you ask. If you ask the guys running AIPAC, they'll tell you it's the threat to Israel. I think probably if we could crawl in Dick Cheney's brain. Well, I'll tell you this. Seymour Hersh says about Dick Cheney. Well, he apparently has talked to people. I believe this is from his Democracy Now! Interview right after. And also his anti-war radio interview with Charles Goyette right after his most recent article, The Redirection, came out, where he said he's talked to people in the vice president's office, very close to Dick Cheney, who've told him that, oh, Cheney is a true believer. He just knows in his heart that if something isn't done to stop Iran from making nukes, that they're going to lose New York or D.C., and it'll be his fault for not doing something about it when he had the chance. And, you know, I don't know whether that's really true or not. I tend to think that in the, you know, the deepest parts of his black heart, it's probably about keeping Iranian oil off the market and its prices artificially high and, you know, guaranteeing more contracts for Halliburton to build and tear down and rebuild military bases at half quality and so forth. But, you know, in terms, if you're trying to figure out here, Alex, that, you know, what is the real threat that Iran poses to the United States, I'm not certain there is one, unless, as Gary North says today on LouRockwell.com, it's their power to start selling their oil in euros and further marginalizing the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. But it would seem to me that that would be all the more reason to make peace with them rather than trying to overthrow them. But, you know, why am I trying to be reasonable talking about Dick Cheney's foreign policy here?
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, typically you have with Iran or Iraq, you usually have three main arguments about why these wars are started. Assuming you don't believe, well, let's say with Iraq, assuming you don't believe that Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, which never existed, were going to come and wipe us out any day. If you don't believe that, the main arguments are usually the oil industry, the military-industrial complex, or Israel's security. With regard to Iran, I'm a little puzzled because I think, if we were to start a war, even just airstrikes or so forth, I think it could really shut down a lot of the oil-producing infrastructure there in the Middle East. You see the Zbigniew Brzezinski, is opposed to trying to start hostilities with Iraq, or seems to be slightly opposed to it. And the other is, if you try to pursue what would happen, or try to imagine what would happen in the long run, a war with Iran would probably be seen by the Russians or the Chinese, as Brzezinski describes, as an attempt to extend U.S. hegemony essentially from Israel's border all the way to India's border, really.
Right, absolutely.
And it will be opposed by the Russians, by the Chinese, and it can get complicated and messy for us.
Well, let me throw this curveball at you. I wonder, I don't have the slightest bit of evidence for this whatsoever, but I just kind of speculate and wonder about the idea that maybe the Russians, in their own way, are kind of working to get us to do this. Because in the long term, you know, as you just said, America, if it does control all the land from Israel to India, you know, our empire will be dead in, 3 years? Less. We can't control the land between Israel and India, not in any long-term sense. And, you know, I think about America paying the Soviets back, so to speak, for Vietnam by luring them into their own Vietnam and Afghanistan. It seems to me that, you know, if I was KGB and I wanted to pay the Americans back in kind again, that, you know, the best thing to do would be, you know, try to get America. I mean, even if they lose some business deals in the short term, there's no better way to destroy America. In fact, there may be no other way at all to destroy America other than to get us to completely overextend and bankrupt ourselves.
Well, it would also help Russia because they're actually a major oil producer. If a lot of the oil-producing infrastructure there around the Gulf is destroyed, and Iran has hinted that it might actually retaliate at Kuwait's facilities and other oil-producing facilities in the region, then the real beneficiary actually turns out to be Russia.
Yeah.
Just the way we talk about Iran having benefited from our occupation of Iraq, Russia could actually benefit tremendously if we were to, in terms of actually having huge military contracts with Iran and
You know, it's funny. So I guess the real question is, whose agent is George Bush, Osama bin Laden's or Vladimir Putin's? Thanks very much for the call, Alex. I really appreciate you calling in, man.
Sure.
The number is 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446. And, yeah, that's the fact, isn't it? Empire weakens America. You know, whatever high standard of living and liberties that we have here in the States, we destroy them and at least put them in tenuous positions when we overextend ourselves all around the world. And it seems to me that George Bush and Dick Cheney are doing everything they can to benefit America's enemies, perceived or otherwise. But there you go. And the funny thing about that, of course, is that Russia doesn't have to be America's enemy at all. I mean, if you had been president when George Bush Sr. was president, you know, never mind that James Baker was his Secretary of State and tried to prevent the breakup of the Soviet Union. Oh, no, the Soviet Union is going to break up quick. Go over there and offer them a bunch of money and see if you can offer them any kind of support, whatever possible, in order to keep the Soviet Union together. But, you know, besides from that, would you not have welcomed the breakup of the Soviet Union and then try to bring them into the West? Try to, you know, I'm not saying... you know, have them join NATO. Think NATO should have been abolished. But wasn't the fall of the Soviet Union the perfect opportunity to say, hey, Russia, you know, as far as we're concerned, pal, you know, you might as well be Western Europe. Come on in. We're friends, right? Yeah, come on. No hard feelings. And instead, what America did went over there and kicked them in the face while they were down. and did everything they could to smash them. And now, you know, as the caller pointed out, Russia is a major oil-producing state. And America, through this clumsy war, has returned them, is in the process of returning them to great power status. Another congrats, and in opposition to the United States, not as a welcome member of Western society. Another great success. And for those of you who think that, you know, somehow we all benefit from all this war. Remember in 2002, all the people who said, yeah, oil is going to be cheap. Even the people who are against the war say, oh, yeah, you know, this war is just about cheap oil. They're just going to steal the oil. Well, we all know that the oil prices have more than doubled since the war began. And as one other piece of little anecdotal evidence I thought I'd mention, today when news that the Iranians were going to let the British sailors go came out over MSNBC, immediately the price of a barrel of crude oil dropped by a dollar. These wars and tensions drive prices up. Uncertainty, you know, more risk means higher prices. There you go. So, yes, your government is screwing you. And in fact, as long as I'm on that, Greg Palast does an excellent job in Armed Madhouse of explaining how your gas price is mostly a hidden tax. And in fact, George Bush once admitted this in a speech, although he stopped and immediately tried to correct himself. The thing is, he got it right the first time. It is a hidden tax, because what happens is you pay, you know, these inflated prices, $2.50 for a gallon of gasoline. And all that money, or not all of it, but a good portion of that money goes to friendly oil-producing states in the Gulf region, particularly Saudi Arabia. And then what they do is they skim enough money off the top to enforce their police state and have coke and whores for themselves. And then they spend all the rest buying U.S. securities. That is, investing in America's debt. And so George Bush can, you know, based on those bonds, create more money to wage his aggressive wars. And so, you know, you might think you got a tax cut. Good old George Bush, the Republican, gave you a tax cut. But then half the price of each gallon of gasoline you pump is going right back into the United States government. And, you know, I just read something. I'm sorry I don't have it here. I think I left it out in the truck. It was the monthly newsletter from the Independent Institute, and it had a great little essay by David Thoreau, David J. Thoreau, who is the president of the Independent Institute in Oakland. And he talked in that all about the biggest portions of the day. He says the national budget this year. And you may have missed this, guys. I'd be sad to think you missed this. The national budget, the national government's budget this year is $3 trillion. $3 trillion. And David Thoreau goes through and he says, look, number one is defense at $800 billion, $750 billion. And then comes Social Security at, I think it was $500-something billion. And then third on the list, interest payments on the national debt. $400 billion. Am I? Nah, see, I don't have the thing in front of me. I should have the thing in front of me. Some incredible amount of tens and I think hundreds of billions of dollars a year just to pay the interest on the debt. The debt that they create so that they can tell you they're cutting your taxes while they inflate your currency and double your gas prices and spend that money on government. Yeah. Anyway, again, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. This is Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. You can also tune us in on 92.7. Antiwar.com, that's where I work. It's your best place for the news and the viewpoints to explain what the hell is going on in the world. We have featured, you know, it's basically the whole page itself, besides our in-house columnists who are great, is basically just 200 or 300 links to all the most important news stories of pretty much every violent conflict in the world. So, you know, whatever it is you want to know, we got it. And from as many wide and varied sources as you could ever find in one place. That's antiwar.com. If you want to hear the archives of any of my radio interviews, such as the previous interview with the heroic Dr. Ron Paul. You can find them all at ScottHortonShow.com. That's Scott Horton, like Horton Hears a Who. Yeah, Horton Hears a Coup. ScottHortonShow.com. There's about 300 or so interviews up there, all with the best anti-government, anti-war personalities and informants and so forth. And if you feel like supporting the show at all, if you're one of the very few who enjoy listening to anti-war radio and me on Radio Chaos, check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com and buy the ones, you know, I made up 98% of the stickers on that site, but the ones in the Scott Horton section are the ones I get the money for. So, you know, why not buy some anti-government propaganda for the back of your car? And very soon there should be, I've sent in another like 50 new ones or something, so keep checking back. There should be some new stickers up there, pretty soon. And, let's see. I wanted to mention, and I did mention, briefly earlier, about, how not anti-war the Democrats are. I mean, hell, just look at history. On the southern side, they got the South into the Civil War. The Democrats did. They got us into World War I. Got us into World War II. Got us into the Korean War. Got us into Vietnam. And, of course, bombed the hell out of everybody in the 1990s. So the Democrats have been the party of aggressive warfare for, 150 years or so. But, the point being that, they are still the party of aggressive warfare. And, there's a great article today by Philip Giraldi, the former, CIA officer, who I interview from time to time here on anti-war radio. And, it's all about the Democrats and how loyal they are to the war party and, wonderfully horrifying, maybe I should say, direct quotes from all the major Democratic presidential candidates about what a threat Iran supposedly is and what violent behavior they're willing to engage in to so-called do something about it. Let's see, I forget the name of the article. I think it's, Democrats Earn Their Stripes in the War Party. That's in the columnists section at antiwar.com today, and it's a pretty sad story to behold. Those of you who think that the left is the opposite of the right, I invite you to go to antiwar.com and read Philip Giraldi's article today about the Democrats and the war party. It'll knock your socks off. And again, I guess I'll give out the phone number, see if anybody else wants to get involved on the show. I know it's just a little pirate radio station. Am I supposed to say that? I know we don't have too much of a presence on the web. But I know there's some people who are fans of the show, so, you know, if any of you guys are listening, call in. Or if you hate it and you think the war is great and you think that, you know, I must be a traitor and want the terrorists to win, you can call in too. And we'll talk all about what a traitor I am. So I guess back to Iran here. The tit-for-tat going on between America and Iran, and I guess the UK counts as part of America to a degree at this point. This is America's fault. America's the aggressor here. As we talked about before, the new article on ABC News, The Blotter, the Americans are financing terrorist groups all over Iran. And it's like, what's his name? Nice. You know the guy I'm talking about, the guy with the movie. Sacha Baron Cohen, who pretends to be, the guy who travels around and sings Throw the Jews Down the Well and all that funny stuff. I can't remember his name. Now I can't even remember how I was going to finish that thought. Kind of ridiculous. Need to smoke less pot before the show. I know what it was. Yeah, where he goes to the rodeo and he says, "We support your war of terror." Yeah, that's exactly what it is, a war of terror. And, of course, the audience at the rodeo all applauds. America supports terrorists all over Iran. At least dozens of, you know, hundreds of people killed in the last few years. Scott Ritter wrote about it in Al Jazeera in the spring of 2005. Said the war with Iran has already begun. And he was right. Azerbaijani terrorists, Baluchi terrorists, Pakistani terrorists, the Mujahideen al-Khalq. America supports terrorism. And I don't just mean, you know, our Air Force bombing people from, 5 miles away. I mean, these so-called stateless private bands of political terrorist radical types. They murder people, and America's running them. It's all part of our wonderful regime change strategy in Iran. And, you know, I was studying the Constitution, and it turns out that regime change is legal. It's okay for the national government of the United States to do regime change in the United States. That's right. It says in the Constitution, I forget which article and section, I guess I could have tried to remember, that the United States has the authority. I guess it must be in like Article 6 or something. They have the authority to guarantee a Republican form of government to every state in the Union. That is, if your state decides to join the United States, then you are ceding them the power to invade your state and overthrow your state government if you abandon an independent judiciary and bicameral legislative branch. They have the power to change your regime and hold new elections and guarantee to you a Republican form of government. Oh, but you know, the funny thing is, the authority for that power stops at the ocean. America does not have the authority to go around changing regimes in other people's countries. But they do, in fact, have the authority to change the regime in the states, as long as the states stay in the Union, which, of course, is up to them. This is something the caller brought up, but I ought to go ahead and go over it for you in case you don't have it memorized yet. Here's the deal. The Non-Proliferation Treaty guarantees the right of all non-nuclear weapon states to have and develop nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. As a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they have a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which allows the IAEA inspectors to come in and monitor all of Iran's nuclear facilities to make sure that they're not cheating. According to Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, there is no evidence, and better, no indication that Iran has diverted any of their nuclear technology to a military or otherwise special source whatsoever. You can read about this every week in the articles of Gordon Prather on antiwar.com. And, you know, do a little bit of Googling around, and you can see for yourself that Iran's nuclear program is based on first-generation centrifuges that don't work very well. They've had all kinds of technical problems from A to Z. And everything that they've done is in the presence of the IAEA, and they're not enriching their uranium to anywhere near bomb grade. So there is no atomic weapons program at all. If you read Seymour Hersh's article, The Next Act, from last November, you'll find that the CIA and the Mossad agree that they have no evidence whatsoever that there even is a nuclear weapons program in Iran. At all. The head of the IAEA says he has no indication that there is even such a thing. So never mind their ability to, I don't know, deliver a nuke to Texas and hurt Texans with it, which is, you know, 100 years away at their current rate. But all the intelligence agencies say if they continue the way they're going, if they begin to attempt to develop nuclear weapons now, it would take them 10 years to get it done. 10 years, and they're not even trying. And the IAEA is there watching everything they do. And, I don't know if it's just a grudge from the 79 revolution. I don't know whether it's just the military-industrial complex wants to sell bombs and airplanes, and Halliburton wants to, you know, tear down and rebuild and tear down and rebuild things for twice the price and half the quality, or you know, exactly who's behind this, except the Israel lobby, which is behind it as loudly as they can possibly be. They're not even being shy about it. You can, you know, read the New York Sun, which is probably the most Israel lobby friendly newspaper in America, and they'll tell you all about it. The Israel lobby is pushing for war with Iran. In this country, the Israel lobby pushed Pelosi to take a provision out of the recently passed Iraq appropriations bill, which simply reminded the president that he doesn't have the authority to bomb Iran. The Israel lobby booed Pelosi and sent her back to her office, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives caved to pressure from a foreign lobby to take out a simple reminder to the president that he does not have the authority to start a war. Wowie. Other than that, I guess I have to assume that Lockheed and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and the rest of these criminals, you know, military-industrial complex, welfare queens, you know, are pushing for the policy too. Although I don't know that directly. I don't know what other interest there is except the lobby of a foreign nation pushing for this war. And it's really hard for me to imagine that Dick Cheney cares, you know, really about what happens to Israel. You know, Dick Cheney? I don't think Dick Cheney really cares about anything except maybe what other people think of him. And which other people he cares about what they think? I don't even know. He surely doesn't care what you or I think. No doubt about that. All right, so yeah, this is Anti-War Radio, and I'll give out the number some more. 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. And I'm Scott Horton, and this is Chaos Radio in Austin. I wanted to congratulate the Washington Post. Everybody give them a round of applause. I can hear you all out there in your cars driving down the road. The Washington Post. Check it out. April 3rd, 2007 has finally decided it's okay to write about the Niger uranium forgeries that helped lie your friends and neighbors into this war in Iraq. And, you know, as Gordon Prather wrote to me, wow, gee, guys, here's my article from more than 2 years ago. That has every bit of information in it that yours does and more. Where the hell have you been, Washington Post? We're supposed to give this guy Pulitzer or something now? Because he's willing to say that the information that supposedly showed that Niger was selling 500,000, was it? Is it 500,000 tons of uranium to unenriched, you know, plain old yellow cake uranium, just barely separated from its ore, that they were going to sell 500,000 tons of it? Or was that right? Was it that much? I think it was, yeah, it was some ridiculous number. They were going to sell all this stuff to Iraq, and obviously that was proof that since this stuff, you can't make a nuke out of it, you'd have to have an extensive enrichment program. Well, that just proves he's got an extensive enrichment program, you know. Yeah, right, even though there was already tons of yellow cake uranium in Iraq under the seal of the IAEA, where the UN inspectors had already taken it and put it in a storage warehouse and left the lock on it. When the inspectors came back, the lock was still on it. They'd been gone since 1998 when Clinton withdrew them. Bush will lie to you and say that Saddam kicked the inspectors out. Clinton withdrew the inspectors before he bombed them in Operation Desert Fox, which he named after Erwin Rommel, the Nazi. But anyway, yeah, it was a bunch of crap, and the Washington Post finally reported about it, so a round of applause for the Washington Post. Yes, it's true. 2 years ago, the Italian paper, the Italian papers told the story of what happened there, and really a lot had been written about it before La Repubblica even came out with their stuff. So anyway, you suck, Washington Post. Thanks a lot, and looks like my good friend Shauna's calling in. Welcome to the show, Shauna. Oh,
hey,
there you
I
are.
I think that you should not underemphasize, in especially in the case of Dick Cheney, the 1979 hostage crisis in their motives for wanting to have a war with Iran.
Yeah, the embarrassment, okay. And the humiliation there?
Yes. Yes. To them, America was humiliated and seen as weak the world over. And, hey, Cheney was in Washington at that time. And I think that he has bitter memories of that, and him and a whole bunch of these older guys would really like to see the Iranians paid back for that.
Well, the funny thing is, though, that you know, these same guys, particularly, you know, Cheney and his associates were the ones who most quickly, it seemed to me, got over the Iranian Revolution and went to try to make friends with them and sell them weapons and deal with them on a regular basis, and have been all along.
Well, you know, that is a good point, but that's kind of like on the side and privately.
Right.
With, you know,
covertly.
The Iran-Contra thing, you know, and that doesn't really take care of their public face.
Right.
Although in my mind, I think our stock rose with the world when we showed patience and forbearance with this obviously weaker country that had the nerve to come on up and take our people hostage.
Yeah.
We could have bombed them back to the Stone Age and didn't.
Yep.
And I think that rather than humiliating us and making us appear weak, that even though the hawks don't understand it, that it really caused people to respect us more.
Yeah, well, here's something that's just driving me crazy is Nancy Pelosi says, you know, I'm going to take a trip to Syria and I'm going to meet with Bashar Assad and, you know, see if we can't see eye to eye on some things here. And Bush denounced her. Bush says, oh, how dare the Speaker of the House go and you know, screw up our policy and this and that. Well, what's the big deal? As I forget if it was Justin Raimondo or Matt Barganier pointed out on the antiwar.com blog, it's perfectly okay for Republican congressmen to go and meet with Bashar Assad as they did the day before Pelosi. That's perfectly all right for Republicans to go and meet and try to see if they can see eye to eye somehow. But when Pelosi does it, that somehow this is criminal. I mean, and this cuts right to the heart of the Bush administration policy in the Middle East. Syria is a danger. We got problems with Syria. We might have to have a war with Syria. And so the policy is to never talk with them and to denounce any American congressman, even the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who goes to try to meet with them. We must not talk with them. Don't you know we're trying to gin up a war here?
Well, you've got an interesting point there. I've never really figured out what the story is with Syria, and it becomes even more mysterious when you think about that they tried to shut down Israel from having talks with them, because presumably the thought is, well, you know, the neocons are concerned about Syria's threat to Israel. But when Israel tries to go ahead and have, you know, diplomatic relations with Syria, they come up and try to stomp that out too.
Well, you know, it's funny. If you go back to 1996 and the clean break policy, this was the kind of thing, this was David Wurmser and Richard Perle and Douglas Feith, among a couple of others, wrote this policy paper for Benjamin Netanyahu saying we need to throw the Oslo peace process in the trash and we need to have, you know, total dominance over this region. That's how we'll have peace with our neighbors, is by being, you know, far too powerful for them to and them far too weak to ever oppose us. And that, I guess that policy sounded great to Netanyahu then, and even to Ariel Sharon, at least up until the time of the Iraq War. But it seems to me that the Israelis have learned their lesson, that this is not necessarily the right policy. And yet Bush and Cheney have bought it hook, line, and sinker. And you often have the Likudniks in America, the neoconservatives in America, to the right of the Israeli government and more belligerent than the Israeli government. And I'm with you, Sean. I would think if these guys really put the interests of a foreign country first, you would think they would at least follow that foreign country's lead and not be more warlike than them.
Of course, it's really easy for the neocons to sit in Washington and say that Israel should be belligerent to everybody, because they're not the ones that are going to get the blowback when they start being attacked by their neighbors.
Right. Yeah, unless they work at the Pentagon.
Or well, they seem to not be there in the offices that get attacked, don't they?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, well, as far as I know, nobody who probably deserved it died in the September 11th attacks, only innocent Americans.
Yeah. Well, it always is. So, as far as the Washington Post thing goes, I think the real kudos should go to antiwar.com and all of the independent journalists out there who kept up enough noise about the Niger thing to force the Washington Post to finally pay attention to it.
Yeah, well, and, you know, there was a little something on RossStory.com a couple of days ago that one of these committees in the House of Representatives has sent a letter to Condoleezza Rice saying they want to know everything that there is to know about the Niger uranium forgeries. So I don't think they called her to testify in person, but they've asked for her, you know, sworn statement as to everything that went on regarding that case. So I'll go ahead and give some kudos to whichever Democratic committee that was. I think the House Oversight Committee, and hope they stay on the right track there and don't blow it, because you know, to get right to the bottom line of it, the Niger uranium forgeries has never really been solved. It's been somewhat concluded that a few guys in Italian intelligence, SISMI, did it for the money, but that's never really been wholly proven. And I'll tell you this, Shauna, I suspect that Ahmed Chalabi and Manachur Gorbanifar and the Rendon Group and a couple of the former CIA guys involved in the Rendon Group, I believe that they were behind the original Niger uranium forgeries, and I can't prove it yet, but I do think that that's what's going on there, and if the Congress wants to really get their act together, they could prove it.
Oh, yeah, and hey, everybody, if you don't know who the Rendon Group is, R-E-N-D-O-N, Google that.
Yeah, the
it's
man
a,
who
it's
sold
a really
the war.
Story.
Yeah, yeah, the man who sold the war by James Bamford and Rolling Stone. It'll knock your socks off there. All right, hey, thanks a lot for calling in, Sean. I appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Talk to you soon. All right, everybody, this is Anti-War Radio. The number is 646-646-646-646. If you're from out of town listening online, it's 512-646-6446. 512, it's called the Austin area. And this is something that I talked about with Chris Floyd, the great reporter and columnist and satirist and a hell of a great interview to Chris Floyd on the show. We talked about the American proxy war in Somalia and how America is supporting the Ethiopian proxy army, which invaded Somalia and overthrew their local homegrown bottom-up Islamic Courts Union, which was far from perfect, but had finally brought order to that country for the first time in 25 or 30 years. And of course, America immediately invaded. And if you read antiwar.com, and probably only if you read antiwar.com or, you know, specific foreign papers, will you know that hundreds of people are dying pretty much every day in Somalia, a land that had finally had peace. You know, at least, you know, I'm not saying their government wasn't a pretty strict and authoritarian government. They would still use violence on you, no doubt. But you didn't have warring factions competing for who was in charge, or not in any way that was really detrimental to the lives of the average person. They'd finally worked that out. And now hundreds of people are dying in Somalia. And one of these guys, one guy escaped from Somalia, made it to the Kenyan border, and was arrested by, I believe originally Kenyan authorities, who turned him over to the Americans, turned him over to the FBI. Well, they interrogated him while you flee in Somalia. I mean, yeah, we just had our proxy army, the Ethiopians, invade to install this United Nations created government. Ugh. But, no, there's no reason for you to flee unless you're guilty of something. You're Al-Qaeda, aren't you? And this guy said, no, I'm not Al-Qaeda. I'm from New Jersey, man. And they said, oh, yeah, you better admit you're Al-Qaeda or we'll turn you over to the new puppet government in Somalia. And he said, dude, I'm not Al-Qaeda, and you're never going to get me to say that I'm Al-Qaeda, dude. Forget it. And they said, all right, fine. Turn him back over to the Somalis, who then turned him over to the Ethiopians. And he has been, this American citizen has been, and you can go to chris-floyd.com and read all about this, this American citizen has been renditioned to Ethiopia. And then today, from MSNBC, U.S. agents eye secret prisons in Ethiopia. CIA, FBI agents looking for Al-Qaeda militants at notorious Ethiopia jails. Nairobi, Kenya, CIA and FBI agents hunting for Al-Qaeda militants in the Horn of Africa have been interrogating terrorism suspects from 19 countries held at secret prisons in Ethiopia, which is notorious for torture and abuse, according to an investigation by the Associated Press. Yeah, that's right. Ethiopia is run by a former Soviet satrap, a former Soviet puppet dictator, who's now reformed and pro-Western and friendly. A butcher. And in fact, I'm sorry that I don't have every tiny ethnicity in Africa memorized yet, although the more the American Empire invades that continent, I suppose the more I will have to learn all about them. But one of these ethnicities in Ethiopia was completely wiped out, butchered by this former Soviet dictator. You talk about a genocidal maniac, he's one of them, and he's America's good friend, and he is torturing suspected terrorists for us, including an American citizen. Including an American citizen. Human rights groups, lawyers, and several Western diplomats assert hundreds of prisoners, who include women and children, have been transferred secretly and illegally in recent months from Kenya and Somalia to Ethiopia, where they are kept without charges or access to lawyers and families. The detainees include at least one U.S. citizen, and some are from Canada. And now, see, that wasn't my crazy assertion there, right? That was me reading directly from the Associated Press up at MSNBC.com today. The detainees include at least one U.S. citizen, and some are from Canada, Sweden, and France, according to a list compiled by a Kenyan Muslim rights group and flight manifests obtained by the Associated Press. Some were swept up by Ethiopian troops that drove a radical Islamist government out of neighboring Somalia late last year. Others have been deported from Kenya, where many Somalis have fled the continuing violence in their homeland. Ethiopia, which denies holding secret prisoners, is a country with a long history of human rights abuses. In recent years, it has also been a key U.S. ally in the fight against Al-Qaeda, which has been trying to sink roots among Muslims in the Horn of Africa. Now, America invading Africa, America propping up dictatorships, America waging proxy wars. Now that's not gonna aid Al-Qaeda. That's not gonna help Al-Qaeda, put their roots down in Africa, is it? No, of course not. You got a problem, the U.S. military can solve it. If it's a problem that the U.S. military created in the first place, well then they can solve that too. All you have to do is just keep killing people until they're all dead. And then there's no more resistance. It's great. And so that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna stop the spread of, Al-Qaeda ideology on the African continent by invading it. That's right. That's what happens when you have a country full of people who think at a sixth grade level and can't possibly take more than one step in their thinking. Let's see. When we invade places, it radicalizes a bunch of people, and more people become terrorists than were there before we invaded the place. Perhaps there's another way to get the few terrorists in a place besides invading them and creating many more. No, I'm sorry, that took way too long. I lost my train of thought halfway through. Pal, what were you saying? I'm gonna put the CD back in. U.S. government officials contacted by the Associated Press acknowledged questioning prisoners in Ethiopia, but they said American agents were following the law and were fully justified in their actions because they are investigating past attacks and current threats of terrorism. The prisoners were never in American custody. Well, one of that's a lie right there, which earlier, I believe, AP article put the lie to that, said an FBI spokesman, Richard Kolko, who denied the agency would support or be party to illegal arrests. He said U.S. agents were allowed limited access by governments in the Horn of Africa to question prisoners as part of the FBI's counterterrorism work. Western security officials, who insisted on anonymity because the issue is related to security matters, told AP that among those held were well-known suspects with strong links to Al-Qaeda. An outsourced Guantanamo. I'm not going to keep reading this. This is a really long article. You can find it, of course, in the top headlines at antiwar.com. It's an Associated Press article. U.S. agents eye secret prisons in Ethiopia. And that's right, there is now an American African command for the U.S. military to complement our northern command, the the new theater of operations of the United States of America that never existed until George Bush was our president. Oh, I'm sorry. That's wrong. They never existed until Bill Clinton was our president. And got a massive boost by George Bush. But now we have an African command. So just sit back and I guess, you know, put your feet up and look forward to, 30 or so years of war in Africa. Y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and The phone number here, if you want to get involved on the air, is 646-6446, 646-6446. And, of course, you're listening to Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And if you're out of town streaming online, it's 512-646-6446. If you want to be on the show. Now, I figured we could talk about how despicable the Republicans are for a little while. Of course, I covered the fact earlier that there's one anti-war Democrat candidate for president. That's Dennis Kucinich, and the rest of them are all pro-war. Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, I think even Chris Dodd, and especially Barack Obama. The Republicans, the Democrats, all pro-war and pro-Patriot Act, except Dennis Kucinich. And on the Republican side, all pro-war, all pro-Patriot Act, except Ron Paul. But you take all the rest of the candidates, John McCain and Mitt Romney and Giuliani and who else am I forgetting? They're all the same anyway. And they're all pro-war, and they're all for destroying your Bill of Rights forever, so that you or your kids and their kids can't have it. They all agree on that, of course, except Congressman Ron Paul. But, I wanted to talk about that slime McCain, the Straight Talk Express. I'd like to recommend an article to you that was written in the L.A. Times by, what's-his-name from Reason Magazine, Matt Welch, who wrote this great article about John McCain and what John McCain really believes and why you ought to look out. Because what John McCain believes is that the government created you, the state created you, it is God on earth, and there is only one legitimate purpose for your life, and that is thanking and serving the state that created you. That is what John McCain believes. Jeffrey Hummel says, Abraham Lincoln didn't abolish slavery, he nationalized it. He changed it from private to public slavery, and that's what John McCain is into. And he's the worst kind of slime. He really does hate liberty, and he really does love the idea of sending other people to go and kill people. And So you can talk about, he's such a hero because he was tortured in the Hanoi Hilton and whatever. Well, I think we'd all been better off if he just died in that crash, because all he's done since he came back to the United States is act in corrupt ways to expand and extend his own power and influence and get innocent people killed. That's what John McCain is about, getting innocent people killed. And he's a real piece of shit. Well, you may have seen that he got in a big fight on CNN last week. They played the clips on The Daily Show, if you watch that for your news, of John McCain saying, come on, you can walk around Baghdad. Everything's fine there. What are you talking about? There's lots of neighborhoods in Baghdad that are perfectly at peace. And Wolf Blitzer says, man, what are you talking about? The rate of people killed is going up, up, up every day, man. It's more than 100 people a day are killed in Iraq. Particularly in Baghdad. What are you saying? And he says, yeah, that's what you think, Wolf Blitzer, but you're going off information from 3 months ago. You're the gatekeeper, mainstream liberal media who won't tell the real truth to the American people about how much progress is being made there. And Wolf Blitzer says, oh yeah, and now Wolf Blitzer, he used to work at AIPAC, for crying out loud. It ain't like he's an antiwar.com type. He says, really, is that true? And he gets the Time Magazine bureau chief in Baghdad, Michael Ware, the Australian reporter, on the live satellite link there. And he says, hey, Michael Ware, I just talked to John McCain, and he says that I got it all wrong. My information is months old, that really everything's just fine in Baghdad. And Michael Ware said, and this isn't me, this is Michael Ware talking, the Baghdad bureau chief for Time Magazine, said, well, I'm not sure which neighborhood in Neverland Senator McCain is referring to, but it's surely not anywhere around here, and I'm telling you right now, Wolf, that you wouldn't last 20 minutes outside the green zone, pal. You wouldn't last 20 minutes. Nobody goes anywhere here without heavy armaments. Give me a break. John McCain has no idea what he's talking about. Made a fool out of this would-be American emperor, John McCain. And so what did John McCain do? He hopped on a plane, and he went to Baghdad, and put American soldiers' lives at risk so that he could do a photo op. And not only did he put American soldiers' lives at risk, but he put Iraqi lives at risk walking through their marketplace. And as Larry the former CIA guy. Almost said Larry McDonald. That's the old John Bircher. I can't remember his name. You know, Larry, the former CIA guy that's on all the TV shows with the chili bowl haircut. Anyway, he came on and said, you notice in these pictures of John McCain's photo op that he's surrounded by American soldiers. There's not a single Iraqi soldier near him at all during this photo op where John McCain is walking through this market. And I have here from the New York Times, Kirk Semple. Baghdad merchants astounded at McCain's claims of security. They say the market he saw, surrounded by GIs and Humvees, was not real life. A day after members of an American congressional delegation led by Senator John McCain, Lindsey Graham was there. You might remember him from when I interviewed military intelligence computer specialist from the Abu Ghraib prison last week, and Lindsey Graham's betrayal when he promised he would get to the bottom of the military intelligence responsibility for the tortures at Abu Ghraib prison, and then, of course, has betrayed Sam Province and the rest of them. That scum of the earth, Lindsey Graham, he was there with John McCain as well. And so New York Times, a day after members of an American congressional delegation led by Senator John McCain pointed to their brief visit to Baghdad's Central Market as evidence that the new security plan for the city is working, the merchants there were incredulous about the Americans' conclusions. What are they talking about? Ali Jassim Fayed, the owner of an electrical appliances shop in the market, said Monday, the security problems were abnormal. The delegation arrived at the market, which is called Shorja, on Sunday with more than 100 soldiers in armored Humvees, the equivalent of an entire company, and attack helicopters circled overhead. A senior American military official in Baghdad said the soldiers redirected traffic from the area and restricted access to the Americans, witnesses said. Sharpshooters were posted on the rooftops. The congressmen wore bulletproof vests throughout their hour-long visit. I wonder how many Predator drones didn't get included in that paragraph. They paralyzed the market when they came, Fayed said in his shop on Monday. This was only for the media. He added, this will not change anything. Of course, this is the same thing whenever Bill Clinton or George Bush come to Austin, Texas, right? They shut everything down because they don't trust us to get anywhere near them either. We're supposed to believe that they don't shut down a market in Baghdad when John McCain comes. He's just strolling on in there. I think I think the Hollywood directors who've been hired to stage these things aren't quite fabulous enough. You guys need more fabulous screen directors to help pull this stuff off. At a news conference shortly after their outing, McCain, Republican Arizona, and his three congressional colleagues described Shorja as a safe, bustling place full of hopeful and warmly welcoming Iraqis. Like a normal outdoor market in Indiana in the summertime, offered Representative Mike Pence, Republican of Indiana, who is a member of the delegation. But the market that the congressman said they saw is fundamentally different from the market Iraqis know. Merchants and customers say that a campaign by insurgents to attack Baghdad's markets has put many shop owners out of business and forced radical changes in the way people shop. Shorja, the city's oldest and largest market, set in a sprawling labyrinth of narrow streets and alleyways, has been bombed at least a half dozen times since last summer. And what they leave out, and in fact, it may just be because this article was written before it happened, but I saw on Keith Olbermann's show last night on MSNBC, within 36 hours or less than that, after McCain's visit to the market, there was a massive truck bombing there, taking innocent lives, of course, just to prove his point. And of course, why did that happen, right? Why did that bomb go off right after McCain's visit there? Because you know, they were trying to make a point. So it's all McCain's fault that those people got killed. He goes and uses these Iraqis who, again, you know, aren't human or merely a cartoon character to a hero like John McCain. He just uses them for a prop. And the fact that they're all going to now be targets when he leaves, yeah, well, nuts to them. And Larry Johnson is the name of the CIA guy I was trying to remember. Anyway, yeah. I guess I could finish this, but I'm not gonna. I hate John McCain. He's the scum of the earth. He's barely human at all. If he's the president of the United States, this country is doomed. Doomed, I tells you. He's a horrible, despicable, evil man. And I wish he would, you know, get hit by a bus or something accidentally. Yeah, this is, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and, you can tell I'm pretty, pretty bad at censoring myself. I wanted to tell you about this killer book I'm reading. Hopefully I'll have an interview for you on the subject by next week. I want to do it this week, but I just have not had any time to get this book finished. It's, Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Disastrous Legacy by Andrew Coburn. I'm sure you're familiar with Alexander Coburn at Counterpunch and his brother Patrick Coburn, who writes such horrifying reports from the Middle East for the London Independent. Well, Andrew Coburn is a hell of a journalist as well. And this book that he's written, Rumsfeld, is just a knockout. I'm only on, I think I've only finished chapter 3. And already, I can tell this is going to be a hell of an interview. In fact, I'm kicking myself for not have taken good enough notes so far. But it's an incredible book. I highly recommend it. Some of you may already have heard some of the anecdotes out of it, such as Bush in August of 2004 asking his almost as retarded father, "Dad, what's a neocon?" What? What did Scott Horton just say? Scott Horton just say that this book says that George Bush didn't ask that question until August of 2004? Come on. Didn't even ask Condoleezza Rice? Does she even know? And there's some other good anecdotes in there, such as about Donald Rumsfeld's insistence that he needed to have photo opportunities out there with the plane crash on the Pentagon lawn instead of, acting as the Secretary of Defense and, you know, perhaps coordinating responses to defend the country from attack. No, Rumsfeld heard that there were smoke and bodies and he wanted to make sure he was in pictures near it. That's right. Oh, why wasn't I at my post? Because I went outside to help others. That's the way the book begins. And it's good. And it's also, I just read chapter 3 is all about how Rumsfeld got the brain cancer causing NutraSweet brand aspartame rammed through the FDA, which I'd read about that a bit before a few years ago. But he really tells, Andrew Coburn really tells the whole story of how Donald Rumsfeld used his connections to get that brain cancer causing chemical through the FDA and in fact how Searle Corporation hired all of the federal prosecutors who were trying to bring charges against them. They all had to recuse their case shortly before resigning to go and work for Searle until the statute of limitations ran out. And they got away with it. So, yeah, that's your diet soda. Give you brain cancer. Look out. And you can thank Donald Rumsfeld for it. If anybody knows anybody who drank a lot of diet soda and had brain cancer, you can thank Donald Rumsfeld for that. And you can read all about why in Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Disastrous Legacy by Andrew Coburn. Also, I have on the shelf here Waiting to be Devoured, Nemesis by Chalmers Johnson, the third in his excellent series, the first, Blowback, the Costs and Unintended Consequences of American Empire. Second one is Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And this one is Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. And Chalmers Johnson is a former CIA analyst, a university professor, former Cold Warrior, in his own words, a former spear carrier for empire. But after the Cold War ended and the American Empire didn't, he went back and revised in his own mind what exactly had happened, and figured out that the Cold War was a ruse. It wasn't defensive, it was offensive, and America was the empire, not the Soviet Union. And not that the Soviet Union wasn't just as evil or far more so, but they weren't an aggressive threat. We were the aggressive threat, and the proof is in the fact that the empire did not end when the Soviet Union fell apart. And so Chalmers Johnson has been trying to save what he calls the old republic, that unfortunately no longer exists, from the scourge of militarism and empire. And he's an incredible author. I mean, seriously, any of you guys, pick up Sorrows of Empire, or I'm sure I can't speak for Nemesis yet, but I can make an educated guess that Nemesis is just as good or better. But if you read Sorrows of Empire, it's a absolutely incredible book, and we'll strengthen your understanding of how this country works and how the world works in great ways. And I know how it is. I mean, I'm this way too. Like, there's some topics that you don't know about, and you consider them and think, you know, not only do I not want to know about that, even if I kind of do want to know about it, I'm not sure I could, or I'm not sure it wouldn't take me, you know, 5 years to learn that subject or something. So I'm just not even going to try to even delve into it, you know. But hey, Sorrows of Empire, Chalmers Johnson's writings, they're the kinds of things where you can learn a couple of years worth of stuff in one good sitting, you know, 2 or 3 days. Read that book, take some notes, and vastly increase your understanding of what it means to have an empire racing towards outright fascism. And good stuff. Chalmers Johnson, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. And you guys may have seen this guy on The Daily Show last week. His name is Philip Zimbardo, and he's the guy who did Stanford University psychology experiment, where he took only, you know, the most normal, well-adjusted, high-grade making kids, and divided them into two groups, prisoners and guards. And I guess they took them to an old prison or something. And, they were just pretending, and everybody knew it. They were students. And, they had to stop the experiment after only 36 hours because the guards were viciously beating the quote-unquote guards were viciously beating the quote-unquote prisoners. And the guards became Nazis immediately. And the prisoners began acting like prisoners. Some of them violently resisting, you know, some of them weeping and going fetal position in the corner. And holy shit, this wasn't real. It wasn't real at all. These were university students. And they had to call off the experiment after 36 hours. A day and a half. They're like, all right, that's it. Everybody out. Forget it. Everybody's fired. Holy crap. And he's got a new book called The Lucifer Principle. And John Stewart interviewed him about it late last week. And it's about the capacity of the average doofus to become a Gestapo agent. The capacity of a normal person, a regular, plain old, average, grab-em-off-the-street kind of guy. And their propensity and ability to be formed into death camp prison guards. And also what it takes for human beings to resist situations like that and instead turn around and become what most people would call a hero in fighting back or resisting, refusing to go along with such things. But this is something that was pretty much revealed by the Milgram experiments with the pretended electroshocks given to people, that the people who were administering them believed that they were real shocks and were willing to give deadly shocks, just as long as somebody standing next to them said, please continue. Oh yes, it's imperative that the experiment continue. And the guy on the other side of the wall is going, no, my heart. Oh, my God, I'm having a heart attack, I think. Oh, please don't shock me anymore. Please let me out of here. And they say, man, should I shock him again? And the doctor says, shock him again, please. And they'll do it. And they'll increase the dosage up until where it's got a skull and crossbones on the meter and says, never hit this button, it'll kill him. And they'll hit the button. Some of them laughing hysterically, some of them breaking down crying, some of them not giving a shit at all until maybe later. They'll do it. And, you know, basically what that means is like, you know, I don't know, the National Guard could come in and, you know, to your apartment complex and take two or three people, give them rifles and make them the guards of the rest of you. They could go to your block in the neighborhood, take four or five people and make them the guards of the rest of you. And they do it. And so anyway, that's an interview that's coming up, and I think he'll be open to the interview because he's written at least one article for antiwar.com before. That's Philip Zimbardo and his book, The Lucifer Principle, about, you know, particularly my interest is how does a government get the average doofus to become a sick, evil murderer? That's obviously what's most important to me. But, you know, in the larger sense, it's all interesting, too. So I guess I'll just wrap it up and go ahead and play some music. Oh, I forgot to mention very briefly when I was on the Republicans. I guess I can just stick it in here. Giuliani. I got time. Giuliani is a fascist. When you hear the word Giuliani, think Mussolini. Giuliani is dangerous to you and your liberty. And here's the proof. This is Giuliani's core belief system right here. You ready for it? Quote, what we don't see is that freedom is not a concept in which people can do anything they want, be anything they can be. Freedom is about authority. Freedom is about the willingness of every single human being to cede to lawful authority a great deal of discretion about what you do. That's what freedom is. Not choosing. Interruption. This is from the New York Times. Interruption from someone in the audience. Giuliani responds, you have free speech, so I can be heard. And by the way, his wife murders puppies. That's right. Rudolph Giuliani's wife murders puppies. And I'm not a Democrat, and I'm not a spinster, and I don't make up shit like that. Google it. Put in Giuliani, wife, puppies, and you will find it in the newspaper. Today and yesterday and the day before that. Her job was doing medical experiments on puppies. Not experiments. Pardon me. Her job was selling medical supplies. And they would do demonstrations on these puppies and then murder them. How would you like that for the First Lady of the United States? A woman who murders puppies. This is Giuliani's third wife, not his cousin. His cousin that he was married to was his second wife. His third wife, puppy murderer. The wife of Rudolph Giuliani. No shit. No shit. Google it. Google it. Giuliani's wife murders puppies. So, yeah. Vote Republican. Yeah. Okay. That's it. That's all I got to say about that. I'm gonna go ahead and, shut my mouth. I guess. And, play some music for you guys. This is, has been, Anti-War Radio. For Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And we'll be back tomorrow from 11 to 1. So thanks everybody for listening. And screw all you people who didn't call in, you jerks. Here we go again, do the same old thing, but that's alright.